So I certainly am familiar with your reputation into the with these two books, and I want to have a chance to read more of your earlier things. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. We'll talk informally. Then I take the tape and I edit it. It's a little news broadcast, which is heard here in New York and has a very modest syndication. It's heard in L.A., in Boston, in Washington.
I actually am familiar with it. It's better known than I think you like.
Well, it's not on the. It doesn't have a very big clearance, but it does have a few stations that carry it, and it has a decided literary thrust.
Great.
So I just thought we'd chat informally, and let me find out a few things about you. I know that you were born in. Well, first, just before we talk, just tell me a little bit about your trip to New York.
Let's see. This has been kind of fun. My wife preceded me with our daughter by a couple of days because they wanted to go see some plays.
How old is your daughter?
15. She's technically, I should say, my stepdaughter, but I have such an amalgamated family from my checkered marital past. And my wife and I both been married previously. We have four children between the two of us. They all have. They all view themselves as
from previous marriages.
Yeah, my wife was married before. She has one child by that marriage, and I have two children by previous marriage. We have one child together, but they're all kind of in a gang. We have most of them. It's a very busy, noisy household. Anyway, we brought two oldest children, 15 and 17, with us, and they've been knocking around. My son's been trying to find the punk rock clubs, and
I think there's one called the Hard Rock,
Hard Rock Cafe.
On 57th Street.
And then there's one.
They used to have a front end of a Cadillac sticking out of the wall. I don't know if
they've. I'm sure they found that. They found one called the Pyramid Club. They found one called Area, where they change the decor every night. One night it might be cages of monitor lizards. Next night it might be priests and nuns. We went last night. We had a small party for the book. A lot of my friends from Montana came here. About 20 of my old pals were here.
From Montana?
Well, there are 10 or 12 from Montana and 6 or 8 from Michigan, where I was born.
They all converged here at the same time?
Yeah, they had. Most of them had other excuses to come, but we get together. I felt really flattered. The whole mob was there. Cousins of mine from as far away as Rhode Island and other places I hadn't seen in a long time were here. It was really kind of fun. We went to a place called The Limelight, which was once a church, and which is now a sort of maniacal nightclub. And lost our voices by 2 or 3 in the morning and went to bed. Anyway, I took the children to that, and they'd been out exploring these famous crawls, and they were just astonished and pleased to find that they could see Dad in such spectacular surroundings with go-go dancers and a topless paper fashions show going on the first floor. All this taking place in the church. It was pretty.
I envy visitors. I live here in Manhattan, and I just don't do anything anymore.
Well, I can see that. That's what would happen. Are we doing this? Are we taking?
Well, I'm rolling, but I just want to.
You know, it's funny
chat informally before, but I ask some questions about your literary past.
Well, you know, I live in Montana. I'm not a native there. I've been living there since I got out of school, and there are all the kind of wonderful things that you can do outside right where we are. My ranch adjoins a wilderness area, and we do just what you do with New York. We don't do most of those things. Everybody comes out and their hiking shoes on in June or July and say, let's climb that mountain or run that white water, and it's like you in the theater or whatever.
Yeah, I used to work in Baltimore and in Delaware for a while and in Pennsylvania, so there was some proximity to New York, and I used to come here a lot and just hit the clubs, and 52nd Street was viable in terms of jazz.
Oh, is that an area of interest for you?
No, I mean not a specific area, but 52nd Street was loaded with jazz places.
Yeah.
If you walk out in front of the CBS building on the 52nd Street side, you'll see some plaques embedded in the sidewalk. They're to honor the great jazz musicians who played.
Gee, I want to see that. Now, tell me how I do that again.
You'll see them. They're buried
on 52nd Street.
On 52nd Street, right in front of the CBS building. They must have maybe. Well, they're going to have plaques the whole length of the street, but they're bedded into the sidewalk.
Fabulous! I love jazz. I'm interested. I'll see that.
But I used to come to the jazz places that were along. They're all gone now, and I used to come up here all the time. And now that I'm here, I tend to come to work and go home.
It's amazing. The older you get, you need your room where you do what you really do, and then do you have a family? Then your family. There's not really much time to do anything else.
That's right. And also, when we came to New York from Baltimore, we had two cars in Baltimore. We sold one of them and kept the Volkswagen for about 6 months, and we sold that. And so I didn't have a car. I've been here for 18 years. I didn't have a car until 1976, and we decided to buy a Chevette, a little car that we could go around the city in.
That's a collector's item?
Yeah, well, it was the first one that was made, in fact. And it just keeps going on and on. It only has 30,000 miles on it.
Right.
shows you how small this borough is. But it gives us a chance to drive out of town. And
Where are you from?
Believe it or not, I'm from Kansas.
Are you?
Yeah.
What part of Kansas?
Wichita. Yeah.
I'm in the horse business, and I had a stallion that I stood down in southern Kansas, Garden City, Kansas, that we kept down there for a while and moved it to Oklahoma.
A great number of my family members live in Oklahoma. My parents, my brother, they live in Texas.
Is that right? What parts of Oklahoma, Texas?
Tulsa and Houston.
I'll be darned.
Mm-hmm. And I went to school in Ohio, so...
Where'd you go to school there?
Ohio University in Athens.
Yep. Well, I'm a Midwestern boy originally. I kind of remember that turf.
So I feel as if I can kind of blanket the nation, or at least this half of it, in my interest. Well, tell me about you now. You were born in Michigan, right?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
I was born in southern Michigan in a small kind of industrial town called Wyandotte. And I grew up in on an island right in the mouth of Lake Erie, about 40, 50 miles north of Ohio, called Gros Eel.
I used to live in Toledo for a brief time.
Well, you know where Gros Eel is, don't you?
No, I don't.
Well, it's just an hour from Toledo, right straight, about an hour north. And it was a great place to grow up, but I think it's quite... I haven't really been home or back there since the 50s much, but it was a good spot. I've always been kind of a sport, you know. There was lots to do. You know, you could race ice boats in the winter and... hunting and fishing and knocking around. It was kind of a good place to grow up, I think.
What did your folks do?
My parents, when I talk about growing up, it kind of throws me up against the fact that my parents were from New England. My mother's from Fall River. My father's from a little town in upstate Massachusetts, and they viewed that as home. And we kind of did, too, because we went back there every summer to stay at my grandmother's house. And so when I look back on what home means to me growing up, it kind of means my grandmother's house to a great extent, since I spent all my summers up there. And, my father was a salesman for most of his life when I lived at home. Later, after I moved away, he had a company of his own. Was a fairly prosperous guy.
What kinds of sales? What kind of company?
Oh, he was what they call a manufacturer's representative. You know, he represented all sorts of stuff, but most of it was centered in and around the automotive business.
Mm-hmm.
And then later he manufactured.
So you were actually born outside of Detroit, very close to Detroit.
Yeah, for example, in the first 15 years that I lived in Michigan, I probably was in Detroit a total of 3 hours, maybe 4 hours.
Oh, lucky you.
Well, I don't know. I've been back. It's funny because I've been back back there since for other reasons. My parents died, and there were state things and stuff that I had to go back there for. I was really out of the nest by the time I was 15. I went off to school and then off to college, and every minute of the time I could spend from that time on, I was out west, and I moved to Montana when I got out of school.
You say you were active in sports when you were growing up. Were you bookish at all?
I was, yes. I mean, I think the main theme of my life was that bookishness, the desire to read and write. That it's nice to have that, which has not changed. I think, for example, if this book failed miserably and I could no longer publish, as long as I didn't go broke, I'd be reasonably happy being a book reader. That would make me very happy. I could have been fairly happy, although I don't think I had great talent that way, being a scholar. I was interested in sports. I played baseball and I played soccer, and I have rodeoed quite a little bit. And since I've lived in the West, I ride cutting horses, which is a sort of a passion of mine. I've gotten reasonably good at that. I've been Montana Wyoming champion for 4 years in a row now, and we raise cutting horses.
Now, cutting horses are what exactly?
That's a quick. It's tough to give you a quick description. Their horses originally in their ranch work were for sorting cattle, going into a herd of maybe thousands of cattle and bringing an individual cow out of that herd. But this demands a tremendous amount of control, rider control, and tremendous amount of ability and cattle reading ability on the part of the horse. And they're very, very highly tuned, super athletic horses. Probably the most, they are probably the horses of which most is demanded in the world. And I ride them and train them some, and we have a band of broodmares whose bloodlines are toward producing cutting horses, in the sense that Labradors are meant to produce retrievers. You know, it's very much a genetically predictable thing. Though.
What did you study at the Michigan State?
Michigan State, I was an English major, and then I went on to the Yale School of Drama, and I studied playwriting there for 3 years. I took a Master of Fine Arts degree in playwriting, and it's a long sort of unacted out daydream of mine to be a playwright, and I'm working on a play now. I've gotten a little bit ahead of the game for the first time in my life, because, you know, fiction writing is an imperfect way of making a living. It's right in there with sharecropping, and you always have to do something else. I've worked in movies quite a little bit, which is a good way to make a living, but it tends to poison your relationship with the book reviewing public. They think it's a sort of a mortal sin, but it's either that or teaching, and I think I had a more ability as a screenwriter than I did as a teacher. So I did that for a long time, but now I'm ahead. The ranch is paid for. My kids are about to go to college. Two of my kids are about to go to college. And I'm working on a play. I'm sort of looped back to 1965, where I left off.
Is that when you graduated?
Yeah, let me think.
Yale?
From Yale, yeah. 62 through 60, yes, 65. Then I went on to, I had the Stegner Fellowship at Stanford, so I was there for a year, and then I've been out of school since then.
What did you do after you left school?
Well, I again, this is peculiar luck that I've had through much of my life. I was working on a novel when I was at Stanford, and I had a small portion of the fellowship left. I took the money and went to Montana and rented a room for $28 a month and finished the novel, and Simon Schuster bought it.
That was at the Sporting Club.
Sporting Club. And I kind of survived for a while in the advance, and the book came out and did fairly well.
What year was that?
It was 1968 or 69. And then there was, believe it or not, there was a movie sale. A very obscure movie was made from it. And I took the money from that, and I bought a little tiny place in Montana, a little tiny place in Key West. And I started just rambling back and forth with a car full of books and junk. And I kind of went back and forth between those two places for a decade anyway.
Do you still have the place in Key West?
No, I still have equity in the place in Key West, but I don't really own a place there anymore, although I seem to find myself going back at least annually, sometimes more often than that. I'm still interested. It's changed vastly since I lived there, which was not all that many years ago. I remember I was looking in the Bushwhack Piano a while ago. It's just been reissued by Vintage Books, and I read this description of this old octagonal house that was around the corner from me, and there was an old lady that lived on the second floor, but used to watch the people walking by in the streets, and she'd been there apparently since the turn of the century. And it suddenly dawned on me, oh yeah, that's Calvin Klein's house. So, and in the sense that I wrote that in 1973, it seemed a permanent part of the Key West landscape, and now it's a, you know, a premier celebrity home.
Why did you develop this preoccupation with Montana?
It was kind of an accident. I had worked on a ranch in the 50s in Wyoming. I was really heading back to Wyoming. And northern Wyoming and southern Montana kind of run together physically. The first place I ever worked out there was in an area called the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness Area. There was a ranch that adjoined that. And I just live on the other side of the same wilderness area. I'm only 45 minutes from Wyoming. It's just a general area that I liked. Well, it was never really a preoccupation with it. Frankly, I was just trying to keep writing, and I had a little bit of money. It was a part of the world I knew I liked. I thought I'd go there until the dough was gone. And the book came out, and children came along, and I never really made a kind of an overhead decision about what I wanted to do geographically. I just was there when I started to make a living, and I've never really moved away.
Tell me about the Wallace Stegner Award that you got, and what that did for you.
Well, it came at the right time. I was just at the point where I was almost, I was in my late 20s. I'd really never made it I'd been writing since I was in my teens. I'd never made any money writing, and I was about to have to face the fact that I was going to have to think of something else to do. And I thought of working in the USIA as my current hero does, and I had thought of teaching. I had thought of going to law school. I was really kind of stymied about what I was going to do, but I was going to finish this one book and go on to the next thing. So this fellowship came along and gave me a year to write. It encouraged me to go on thinking of myself as a writer, which I think is the biggest thing those things do for you. Plus, Stegner and the other people around the place made it clear that you were free to use the fellowship as you saw fit. They hoped you would write, but there was no pressure to do anything, which increases your sense of responsibility. So I wrote as maniacally as I could for that year, and I finished a book, and that was. And I've been.
It was a well received first novel.
It was, yeah. It did. And on the basis, novels are—you never really make a living writing novels unless you're extremely famous novelist. But it does enable you to do other things to make a living. For example, from then on, I was able to work for Sports Illustrated on a regular basis and write for other quarterlies and magazines because I had a book out. It was basically kind of entry level thing for other possible ways of making a living. And then. Not long after that, I think I wrote a screenplay, which I saw. But really, that was a year, a nice free year to kind of get all the loose elements together and try to get something done.
Tell me about your movie writing. How did that develop? I know you wrote the screenplay, Missouri Breaks.
I did. I've written three movies. I wrote The Missouri Breaks, Rancho Deluxe, Tom Horn, which was, I think, McQueen's last movie. A producer named Elliot Kastner bought the film rights to 92 in the Shade. And we then developed a kind of relationship at that time for, professional one. He said, well, is there anything else you'd like to do? And I said, yes, I'd like to try writing an original screenplay. And that really stemmed from my interest in playwriting. And screenplays and plays are not all that different. So I wrote Rancho Deluxe. And it was immediately done, and then the following year, if I've got my chronology right, which I'm not great at, the following year I wrote and directed 92 in the Shade.
You directed that too?
I directed that. And let me think. I believe it was 2 years after that I did The Missouri Breaks.
Uh-huh. At some point during this period, you must have been expanding your ranch in Montana.
Yeah, we have a ranch that's big enough to qualify as a working ranch. The cattle business is...
It's just a little smaller than Delaware, isn't it?
My ranch?
700 acres, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, that's a lot of ground, certainly to me, but that's not much of a ranch in Montana. I have friends with ranches who have 200,000 and 300,000 acres, and they have a crack at viability. I would say... My ranch, if I were a real cattle rancher, which I'm not, raising a family on that ranch would barely be big enough to support a small family. If you worked that ranch very, very hard and you filled it up with the mother cows, put up your own hay, irrigated it yourself, you would probably make between $8,000 and $10,000 a year.
So the ranch is not really income producing for you?
It is at a low level. We run horses on it. We don't have any hired help. I do my own irrigating. My son and I fix the fence. And we're viewed as a business by the IRS. I've been audited once and passed. But I wouldn't want to be a full-time rancher. There's not enough about that interests me. But I like running this band of horses and I like the fact that it gives all of us and my family something to hook up to and work on and see improve. And
where in Montana is the ranch?
It's south of Livingston, Montana. To place that in your mind, if you can picture this, it's immediately north of Yellowstone Park.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's October now. I see Denver had a huge snowfall. It must be pretty cold in Montana already, huh?
Yeah, it is. Although it might be warm by the time we get home tomorrow.
What kind of winters do you have?
They vary. Last year, for example, we had tremendous cold in the month of December. My house had stayed between 20 and 30 below zero for almost 2 weeks. But then when that warmed up, winter never returned. It just stayed kind of, but they're not miserable. It's a dry climate, and a typical winter day is probably warmer and more comfortable than it is here in New York.
Yeah, it gets humid here. Sometimes the chill gets into you.
Yeah, I think most winter days, the children are outside all the time, so it's not bitter. There are parts of Montana, the area they call the High Line up on the Canadian border and stuff is terribly cold.
Do you have a special place in your home for where you work?
Yes, kind of. I just kind of added a room this year so that I could close the door off and stay away from the house. And sometimes I'll rent a room in town if I'm feeling, when I finished this last book, I needed, I thought, 4 or 5 months to really get away from everything. And I rented a room in the town of Livingston, and I drove back and forth like a banker, and that helped. I've never really worked that out very well. I'll work in the bedroom sometimes, and I'll work on the kitchen table, and then I'll wish I had a studio, and then I think how pretentious those are, and they somehow. I just read Susan Cheever's wonderful book, and she said her father used to point at people's book-lined studios with their leather chairs and say it doesn't seem to be helping their writing.
No. I was talking to a writer in Georgia, a writer named Terry Kay. He's published by Simon & Schuster. He wrote a wonderful, wonderful novel about a mass murder called Dark 30. And he's got a lot of kids, and it's so noisy that he can't work at home. He just can't do it, so he looks for the cheapest motel room he can find. And he locks himself in the motel room and for days. He'll work all night. He'll work 24 hours straight, and he'll just stay there and work.
Is that right? Now, that wouldn't work for me. For some reason, I don't work fast enough to be able to do that long enough to survive it. I really, my system is to just pick away day after day after day on fairly reasonable hours. The beginning of a project, it might be only 2 or 3 hours work a day. But as it goes along and you become kind of that book's first reader and there's a certain kind of excitement infects you, then you end up working 8 or 10 hours a day. But I need
to... hard to put it aside then.
Then it's hard to put it... Then you're actually kind of having fun and you're drawn to it. You want to see what's going to happen. But normally I need to keep the kind of hours that I can do day, you know, for long stretches, because it's the only thing that works for me.
Your books are set in the West, and obviously I guess we can call you a Western writer. It's hard to do that, knowing that your heart was in New England and your home was in Michigan, and now you're transplanted to the West.
I've gotten to feel that way, though. I've lived half my life now out there, and all my children are, you know, born there, and that's kind of come to be home. But I certainly don't see myself as a regional writer, you know.
I was talking to, what's his name, Alvarado Rios, and he has won the Western Book Award for fiction. He lives in Tempe, Arizona. And he's a young, very young man, younger than you are, and he's had 2 books out, won a book of poetry. He writes, all of his stories are set in Arizona, mm-hmm. where he grew up. And I asked him if he thought that the winning this award would characterize him as a regional writer, and he thought perhaps, but he wasn't going to let that stop him from, mm-hmm. from writing
about New York if he wanted to.
What's that?
He wouldn't let him stop. It wouldn't stop him from writing about New York if he felt.
Well,
like
that would be pretty hard for him. I think when he was here in town last month, I think it was his first visit to New York. Yeah, I think it would be pretty hard to get the feeling of New York without having living here. Mm-hmm. Although I was talking to one writer by the name of Robert Byrne. He lives in San Francisco, and he wrote a thriller about a building that collapsed called Skyscraper. And he came to New York. He doesn't come here very often, except on short visits as a tourist, but he came in for 2 weeks to research it, and then he set his novel here. But he wasn't trying to develop the New York character. You know?
Right,
he needed
just to information.
Look at the landscape and this sort of thing. So, but your characters seem to be deeply ingrained in the West.
Well, I have a lot of feeling for the place. I'm not sure really why I do, but I've life is relatively short, and 16, 18 years in one place, you start to project yourself into the life of that place, and I've felt that way, and I've been really real absorbed in the activities of my area. I I live out among the ranchers and have done for a long time now. Those people are a big part of my gang there, and I love the country. I know it. I know it probably better than a lot of people who grew up there because I spent so much time walking around and hiking around, taking pack trips in it and floating the rivers, and in some ways I have a pretty good feeling for it, I think.
Tom McWane, can you, in your own words, give me kind of a synopsis or perhaps give me the theme for Something to be Desired?
I'm not sure I can do it quick. I'll do it. Let me see how well I can do on this. This is a book about a man who grew up with a rather shattered view of how families function, and has to go forth and try to develop his own, and thereby making a lot of purgatorial mistakes that he pays for. Comically mostly, but pays for. And at some point in the course of this novel, the protagonist discovers that the self, the ego, is not the sole source of information for people who want to live successfully. And he crosses a kind of personal line of demarcation and begins to see the world around him, especially the people he loves, and especially his son. And it's in a way he's set free, kind of at the end of the book, to begin to build a life that a luckier man might have started out at age 8 building. And that's really the theme of it. It's the discovery that there's a life beyond the self. It's about the crimes of narcissism that the 60s and 70s set us up to commit, and the failure of egoistical romance.
Tom McWane, who are some of the writers that you read today and some of the writers who have influenced you?
Well, I'm kind of an omnivore about reading. I'm the child of two Irish grandparents, or two Irish parents and four Irish grandparents, and I had a kind of a vanity about that for a long time. And I used to read lots of the Irish writers, notably, you know, Joyce and Flann O'Brien and Brenda Behan, and I liked those guys very much. I liked most of the standard American authors, Hemingway and Faulkner, and I was a great fan of Sherwood Anderson's. The writers there are so many good writers around right now, it's hard to make a list without feeling you've left somebody extremely important out. But I love the work of Barry Hanna, a Mississippi writer. I like Robert Stone very much. I like my good friend Jim Harrison very much. Don Carpenter, who was a writer who should be vastly better known than he is.
I don't know him.
He's a tremendous writer. He's the most neglected writer in the English language, in my opinion.
Hmm.
He wrote a book called Hard Rain Falling. He wrote a book called A Couple of Comedians.
Who's his publisher?
Simon & Schuster, I think.
I don't know him.
I like Norman Mailer very much. I think probably for the writers who are in for all 9 innings, who are really courageous about what they attempt, and more than reasonably successful in what they achieve, I think Mailer is somebody that I look up to.
He's a genius. He's one of these people who he thinks on the page. He can just sit there and think on the page and turn it in.
I don't think anybody has caught the sense, the feeling of the contemporary West more authentically than Mailer did in the Executioner's Song. How he did it is a matter of artistic magic. So... he's a wonderful. I met him on this trip, but I've never met him before. He's also a marvelous, genial, lovely guy.
I hear that. I don't know him. I have never talked to him. I'm going to have to do that one of these days.
Well, believe me, it's no letdown.
But he used to be kind of wild in his younger days. Punch people out.
They probably deserved it.
But you know, he still boxes.
Yeah. Well, he's a gent. He's the real thing.
I think he's calmed down a lot. But he used to drink a lot, and mm-hmm. he used to be very angry.
I didn't sense that. I don't know him well. I've just spent a couple hours with him. Saul Bellow is somebody I admire immensely.
Do you have a big library at home?
Yeah, books all over the place, piled everywhere. We're all readers.
Mm-hmm. You don't have it organized,
set, not very well. I've had a plan for the last 12 years to alphabetize it.
I was talking to, you probably are not a fan of Louis L'Amour. I don't know if you are or not. But
arm's length way.
Like, he's not your kind of, he doesn't have your style at all. He's mm-hmm. He is a writer who does not develop character very well mm-hmm. and is really writes stories, I think, more than anything else, which is all right. But Louis he lives in Los Angeles now, and he has a library that he had specially built for him with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves that are double, so that you can open the bookshelf outward. I don't know if I can imagine it, but I can't quite picture how he does it. And there's a second row of books behind.
Really?
And another shelf. He has that many books.
My gosh.
And he is a book collector. He, mm-hmm. he likes to buy histories. And
mm-hmm.
He does all of his own research with his own books for all of the histories of the West mm-hmm. and of Europe and the Crusades and things like that. And he buys them for rare book dealers, and he shops around, and he has his own library, which is supposed to be magnificent.
That actually sounds kind of appealing. He's got a book on the bestseller list now that seems to be totally outside of what he's known for.
Yeah, what was that called?
I don't know.
Something.
Set in the Middle Ages.
No, it's called The Walking Drum, I believe it is.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that was set in the 15th century, I believe. A band of walking merchants through... through Europe. Yes, it's not a Western at all. But he has written quite a few books that are not Westerns.
And evidently he writes a book in two or three weeks' time.
Yeah, he just really knocks. Most of his books are in paperback.
Yeah.
But one interesting...
The cowboys where I live all read them. I mean, every cowboy's got a huge chest of Louis L'Amour's. In fact, they kind of model their lives on his inventions. It's quite funny now.
His information is absolutely authentic.
Yeah, I hear that too.
But he, unusual, he's got a book club that only sells Louis L'Amour books. I think it's called the Louis L'Amour Collection. And they're kind of phony leather bindings.
With scenes of the West in the background.
So people who like it can order his books. They're all being reprinted. All the old paperbacks that he had, they're all being reprinted in these leather-bound editions just for the members.
Is this what they call niche economics?
I see them around occasionally, but
they're very popular where I live. They're part of the West. Really hasn't got much genuine tradition, as you must know, and it's a people grab at anything that gives them an enlarged sense of the presence of the white man in the West. It's a very funny place to live. You know, just the Southern writers are preoccupied with the Confederate past. You know. If you live in the West for a long time, you really get you have to start getting a funny feeling about the 5,000 years of Indian history that preceded it, because it's, you know, if you have a ranch, you know, if you plow up any ground, you find all these signs of this. But for most of American literature about the West has kind of taken the position that these were either not humans, or they were like the wildlife of the region. There was not a human history there until the 1880s and cattle and the white men got there, but there was an exciting, immensely long, fascinating past there, and we have quite a bit of information about it. And once you sort of touch that, you read, for example, the Chronicles of Two Leggings and some of the old warriors whose memoirs were taken down in the 90s and the turn of the century, you realize that they had the best of the West. That was the great history of the place.
Well, Thomas McGuane, it was certainly a pleasure meeting you, and I'm glad to have had the opportunity to have you in, and I hope that we can have you back. We can.
Great.
Certainly not going to run out of things to talk about.
It seems not.
So are you planning on a book on a pretty regular schedule now?
Well, that's my, occupation and my preoccupation. I'm writing a play now. But I'm always at work on a novel to some degree or another, and I'll be right back at that day after tomorrow when I get back to the ranch.
Well, when the new one comes out, let's get back together. We'll
love to do that.
Continue our talk.
Thanks for having me this time.